Okay. Thank you, Dominic. And thanks also to Deborah. I guess she's out sick, but thank you to her for setting up this talk tonight. So recently I've been interested in the media of multiplicity, and that's taken me backward to the 19th century to look at photography, in fact, particularly these strange photographic apparatuses that have multiple lenses. And it's also taken me into the middle of the 20th century to look again at cybernetics. So the talk today kind of flows out of that second half work that I'm engaged in now. Of all the recent revivals in recent years, a period of history in which the revival itself has been honed to such a degree that it persists as mere blank parody, the revival of Hegel is the most startling, although certainly not for those involved. Hegelianisms of all shapes and sizes prevail today, from Catherine Malabou's dutiful reconstruction of the plastic dialectical transformations to the hysterical anti-materialism of Slavoj Žižek and his convocation of the inescapable bind between the determinate negation and the wholly other, from which explodes the terror of proletarian power. Is not Woody Allen's character Alvy Singer in Annie Hall the perfect summation of Žižek's political project? Okay, I'm a bigot, but for the left. Or consider the unrepentant Hegelian Alain Badiou, who stakes everything on being as a pure formalism that only ever realizes itself through the event and absolute departure from the state of the situation. Only the Hegelian dialectic, and not the Marxist one, can snap back so cleanly to its origins like this, suggesting in essence that Aufhebung was always forever a spectralization and not a mediation in general. That, in other words, the ultimate truth of the Hegelian dialectic is spirit, not negation or becoming or anything so usefully mechanical. The negation is thus revoked during synthesis, much more than it is resolved. This would be one way to read the current intellectual landscape, as so many revoked materialisms, so many concepts too terrified by matter to matter. And so the question comes again, is the dialectic a medium, or does the dialectic demonstrate the absolute impossibility of any kind of mediation whatsoever? What is the status of the obscure, of negation, of the dark corners of being that are rarely ever subsumed by dialectical becoming, or even strategically excluded from it? So where are we now? In an essay from 2001, the French collective Ticoun speaks of what they call the cybernetic hypothesis. At the end, and I'm quoting, at the end of the 20th century, the image of steering, that is to say, management, has become the primary metaphor to describe not only politics, but all of human activity as well, end quote. The cybernetic hypothesis is, in Ticoun's view, a vast experiment beginning in the overdeveloped nations after World War II and eventually spreading to swallow the planet in an impervious logic of administration and interconnectivity. Another quote, the cybernetic hypothesis is thus a political hypothesis, a new fable. It proposes that we conceive of biological, physical, and social behavior as both fully programmed and also reprogrammable. The essay is interesting. This is the essay called The Cybernetic Hypothesis. Is interesting not so much for T. Kuhn's description of the late 20th century, a description of cybernetic society that has become increasingly common today. Rather, it is interesting for how the collective describes the appropriate political response to such a hypothesis. They speak of things like panic, noise, and interference. They propose counter-strategies of hypertrophy and repetition, or as they put it, to execute other protocols. Yet there's always a strategic obscurantism in their prescriptions. What T. Kuhn calls here invisible revolt. Quote, it is invisible because it is unpredictable to the eyes of the imperial system, they write, lauding the virtues of things like mist and haze. Quote, fog is the privileged vector of revolt. Fog makes revolt possible. Invisibility is not a new concept within political theory. But what I would like to explore here is a specific kind of invisibility, a specific kind of blackness that has begun to permeate cybernetic societies. And further, that this blackness is not simply an effect of cybernetic societies, but is in fact a necessary precondition for them. The black box, an opaque technological device for which only the inputs and outputs are known. The black block, a tactic of anonymization and massification often associated with the direct action wing of the left. Somehow these two things come together near the end of the 20th century. Is there a reason for this? Okay, if you close your laptop tight, what do you see? A smooth, outer, opaque shell hiding and housing a complex electronic machine within. With the lid down, there is little with which to interact. Pick it up, put it down, not much more. Now open it and see the situation reversed. Now concave, the external surface of the machine is no longer opaque and smooth. Rather, it is plastered over with buttons and sockets, speakers and screens, boxes and windows, sliders and menus, clicks and drags, taps and double taps. Splayed open, the box begs to be touched. It exists to be manipulated, to be interfaced. There are two kinds of black boxes. The first is the cipher, and the second is the function. With the lid closed, the laptop is a black box cipher. With the lid up, a black box function. So first, the black box cipher was very common during modernity. Marx articulated the logic quite cleanly in Capital Volume 1 with his description of the commodity as having both a rational kernel and a mystical shell. It is a useful device for Marx, portable, deployable, useful whenever the dialectic needs to be triggered. Thus, the commodity is a black box cipher, but so is value. And so is the relationship between exchange and production, ditto for the class relation, and so on. Superimpose the cipher and begin to decode. This is the rational kernel mystical shell logic at its most pure. Untouched, the phenomena of the world are so many ciphers, so many mystical black boxes waiting to be deciphered to reveal the rationality of history, of totality, harbored within. The black box cipher is similar to Leibniz's monad. Like the monad, the cipher has no windows. It is a cloaked node with no external connectivity. Think again of the laptop with its lid closed. The case is a turtle shell designed to keep out what is out and keep in what is in. This is what the commodity is, to be sure. But it is also, as I'm suggesting, what the sign is, what spectacle is, and what all the other cultural phenomena that are that model themselves after this kind of commodity logic. Interiority is all. Interface is but a palliative decoy, a flourish added for people who need such comforts. Okay, we have here only one half of the story, a half that has served quite nicely for decades, but nevertheless needs to be supplemented because, quite simply, the mode of production itself is now a new one with new demands, new systems, and even perhaps new commodities. So, if it could speak today, the black box would speak like this. Let us reconnect to the noisy sphere where everything takes place on the surface and in full view of everyone. For this is the plane of production, on whose threshold is already encoded a million mantras for the new economy. Do what feels right. Reach out and touch someone. Play hard. Don't be evil. Fortified with a bright array of buttons and windows, the monad ceases to be a monad. It is still the old cipher in some ways, only now it has an interface. It is a cloaked node, one whose external connectivity is heavily managed. Consider how a function works in computer languages, or an API, an application programming interface, or a network socket. What is consistent across all these technologies is the notion that visibility should be granted, but only selectively, and under stricture of specific grammars of action and expression. So while its conceptual origins go back to Marx in the 19th century, the term black box enters discourse proper in the 1940s via military tech slang. Seeking the origins of the black box, Philip von Hilgers recently recalled in an essay the year 1940 and the Battle of Britain, particularly the transport out of the country of some of Britain's technical secrets via the so-called Tissard mission. An emergency wartime diplomatic expedition, the Tissard mission, arrived in Washington, D.C. on September 12, 1940, carrying vital items packed inside of a black metal box, with the hopes that American scientists could assist their British allies in developing new technologies for the war effort. Inside the black box was another black box, the Magnetron, a small microwave-emitting tube suitable for use in radar equipment, which had been modified in recent years from a transparent glass housing to an opaque and therefore black copper housing. On a small scale, the Magnetron was a black box that allowed the Allies greater flexibility with their radar. But on a larger scale, the confrontation of the war itself was a veritable black box theater in which enemy objects and messages were frequently intercepted and had to be decoded. The new sciences of behaviorism, game theory, operations research, and what would soon be called cybernetics put in place a new black box epistemology in which the decades, if not century-old traditions of critical inquiry, in which objects were unveiled or denaturalized to reveal their inner workings, and this would include everything from Descartes' treatise on method to both lineages of critique, the Kantian and Marxian lineages, to even the Freudian plumbing of the ego, that this was replaced by a new approach to knowledge, one that abdicated any requirement for penetration into the object in question, preferring instead to keep the object opaque and to make all judgments based on the object's observable comportment. In short, the behaviorist subject is a black box subject. The node in a cybernetic system is a black boxed node. The rational actor in a game theory scenario is a black boxed actor. Warren McCullough describes the black box at a meeting in Princeton during the winter of 1943-44, attended by a number of people, including Norbert Wiener, Walter Pitts, and others. So I'll read a quote. "We were asked to consider the second of two hypothetical black boxes that the Allies had liberated from the Germans. No one knew what they were supposed to do or how they were to do it. The first box had been opened, and it exploded. Both had inputs and outputs, so labeled. The question was phrased unforgettably. This is the enemy's machine. You always have to find out what it does and how it does it. What shall we do?" Warplanes often contained technology such as radar that should not fall into the hands of the enemy. So to avoid this, such technological devices were often equipped with self-destruction mechanisms. So when McCullough says in this hypothetical scenario that I just read that the first black box exploded, he is referring to the fact that its self-destruction mechanism had been triggered. Black box number two remained intact. They didn't try to open it. And no telling if there would ever be a chance to capture additional boxes with which to experiment or try to extract useful secrets. Thus, no attempt could be made to explore the innards of the second box, lest risk a second explosion. Any knowledge to be gained from the second box would have to be gained purely via non-invasive observation. The point here is that because of these auto-destruct mechanisms, it was inadvisable, if not impossible, to open up devices, black boxes, gleaned from the enemy. The box must stay closed. The box must stay black. One must concentrate exclusively on the outside surface of the box, its inputs and outputs. Okay, so this is just a historical vignette, of course. Yet, as this new epistemological framework developed via what, following Norbert Wiener, Peter Galison calls the Manichaean sciences, and what Tikkun called the cybernetic hypothesis, which is to say cybernetics, operations research, behaviorism, neural nets, systems theory, cellular automata, game theory, and all of these disciplines that essentially get invented in this period and create sort of the conditions of existence for the world we're living in today, it became more and more clear that the black box was not simply an isolated device. The black box grew to become a constituent element of how entities and systems of entities were conceived. The cybernetic philosophy was premised on the opacity of the other, writes Peter Galison. We are truly, in this view of the world, like black boxes with inputs and outputs and no access to our or anyone else's inner life. That's a quote from Peter Galison. It is thus today no longer a question simply of the enemy's black box, but the black boxing of the self, of any node contained in a network of interaction. The enemy's machine is not simply a device in a German airplane. It is ourselves, a call center employee, a card reader at a security checkpoint, a piece of software, a genetic sequence, a hospital patient. The black box is no longer a cipher waiting to be unveiled and decoded. It is a function defined exclusively through its inputs and outputs. Is this the death of Freud and Marx and hermeneutics in general? At the very least, one might say that Marx's principle for the commodity has finally come full circle. Today, instead of Marx's famous rational kernel in the mystical shell, one must come to grips with a new reality, the rational shell and the mystical kernel. For our skins are already tattooed. Our shells are keyboards. Our surfaces are interactive interfaces that selectively allow passage from the absolutely visible exterior to the absolutely opaque interior. The shell is rational, even as the kernel remains absolutely illegible. These new black boxes are therefore labeled functions, because they are nothing but a means of relating input to output. They articulate only their exterior grammar while black boxing their innards. Computer scientists quite proudly and correctly call this technique obfuscation. It's a term of art in computer science. So the function black boxes include things like the computer, the protocol interface, data objects, and code libraries. And in fact, RFC, one of the protocols, RFC 950, on subnetting procedures, puts the principle, I think, quite well. Quote, this is about netting and subnetting. Each host sees its network as a single entity. That is, the network may be treated as a black box to which a set of hosts is connected. This new industrial scenario is one in which a great premium is placed on interface, while interiority matters very little, assuming, of course, that everything is in its place and up and running. These black boxes have a purely functional being. They do not have essences or transcendental cores. So this is why one must invert the logic of Marx's famous mandate to descend into the hidden abode of production. In other words, and to repeat, it is no longer a question of illuminating the black box by decoding it, but rather that of functionalizing the black box by programming it. To be clear, the point is not to ignore the existence of the new black sites of production, from maquiladoras to PC rooms. On the contrary, these black sites are part and parcel of the new industrial infrastructure. The point instead is to describe the qualitative shift in both the nature of production and, perhaps more importantly, the nature of the consumer. For only by describing this new structural relationship can we begin to speak about the structure of critique or the structure of action. In other words, if Marx's descend into the hidden abode of production, which if you remember comes at a very crucial point in Capital, Volume 1, if this mandate to descend into the hidden abode of production was an allegory for critique itself, what is the proper allegory for critique today? If neither the descent into production nor the illumination of hiddenness are viable options, what's left? And I hope it's clear that for me the descent and the illumination are the problematic terms here. I'm not against examining production or anything like that. From the student occupations at the New School to the political tracts circulating through the University of California, to Tikkun and the Invisible Committee and other groups, there is, interestingly, a new political posture emerging today. A new political bloc with an acute black box profile. A new mantra being heard is, we have no demands. We don't want political representation. We don't want collective bargaining. We don't want a seat at the table. We want to leave be, to leave being. We have no demands. So I think the power behind the so-called no demands posture is precisely that it makes no claim about power at all. Instead, it seeks to upend the power circuit entirely via a kind of political non-participation, you might call it. It would be wrong to cast this aside using the typical epithets of cynicism or nihilism, or even to explain it away using the language of state power versus terrorism, which we should remember is the language of Lenin just as much as it is the language of Bush, Obama, Sarkozy, and all the rest. For the key to this new political stance, I think, is in its subtractivism vis-a-vis the dimensions of being. And I mean that quite literally. Subtractivism vis-a-vis the dimensions of being. So are we not today at the end of a grand declension narrative, beginning over a century ago, from time to space and now to appearance itself? And I'll explain what I mean. Is not the 19th and early 20th century the moment in which time enters Western thought, only to be supplanted after World War II by space as a new organizing principle? So we can speak, therefore, first of an aesthetics and politics of time, going back to Hegel and Darwin and Marx, to be sure, but also achieving central importance in the work of Bergson, Heidegger, even somebody like Benjamin with his interest in nostalgia and reproduction, or even Einstein's scientific treatment of time, or consider the great so-called 1900 media, as Kittler calls them, the phonograph, the cinema, and all the other temporally serial recorders of empirical inputs. The subsequent breakthrough of structuralism, then, was not so much the elaboration of the linguistic structure, but the synchronic as such, the anti-temporal, a development so startling that it must only be balanced and recuperated with an equally temporal counterpart in the diachronic. Nevertheless, if the earlier phase introduced a politics of time, the post-war period ushered in a new politics of space. So by the 1970s and 80s, we hear of things like situations and geographies, of territorializations and lines of flight, of heterotopias and other spaces, of nomadic wanderings and temporary autonomous zones, fueled in part by Henri Lefebvre's landmark, The Production of Space, 1974. And of course, it was Frederick Jameson who put forward the notion that postmodernism is not simply a historical periodization, but quite literally the spatialization of culture. And hence his more recent call for a reinvention of the dialectic itself, not so much as the so-called engine of history, but as an engine of spatiality, or a spatialized history, as he calls it, a spatial dialectic. Okay, so this dimensional subtractivism from time to space leads to a third step, the politics of the singular dimension. Binary in nature, it reduces all politics to the on-off logic of appearance and disappearance. These are, of course, the stakes of any periodization theory whatsoever, not so much to assert that computers have taken over, or even the old vulgar truism that the so-called computer revolution is less the rise of computing as a new industrial vanguard, but the wholesale reorganization of all sectors of industry around these new digital devices, such that agriculture and logistics and medicine are now all equally computerized. Not so much that, but that a certain kind of logic, the binary, multiplicity, supplementarity, perhaps, that a certain kind of logic has come to be associated with a certain historical incarnation of the mode of production. The perverse irony, if we can call it that, is that today's binary is ultimately a false binary. For unlike the zeros and ones of the computer, which share a basic numeric symmetry at the level of simple arithmetic, the binaries of offline and online are so radically incompatible that they scarcely interface at all. In fact, the interface between them is defined exclusively through the impossibility of interfacing. Right? The positive term, say the online, carries an inordinate amount of power, while the negative term carries an extreme burden of invisibility and alterity. Today's politics, then, is a kind of, you might call it a kind of rampant dark Deleuzianism, in which affirmation of pure positivity and the concomitant acceptance of the multiple in all its variegated forms results nevertheless in the thing it meant to eradicate. The negative, right? A strict binarism between us and them, between the wired world and the dark continents, between state power and the terrorists. And again, I think the no demands posture flies in the face of all of this in an interesting way. So again, the proposition. The politics of the new millennium are shaping up to be a politics not so much of time or of space, but of appearance. So instead of Debord or Jameson or Lefebvre, a new radical syllabus is shaping up today. Virilio's The Aesthetics of Disappearance, Lyotard's The Inhuman, Levinas's On Escape. Instead of a politicization of time or space, we are witnessing a rise in the politicization of absence and presence-oriented themes, such as invisibility, opacity, anonymity, the relationship between identification and legibility, the tactics of non-existence and disappearance, new struggles around prevention, the therapeutics of the body, piracy and contagion, informatic capture, and the making present of data via data mining. It is no coincidence that groups like Tikkun use anonymous umbrella names for their practice. Here is the Invisible Committee on the superiority of tactics of opacity over tactics of space. So this is a quote from Invisible Committee. For us, it's not about possessing territory. Rather, it's a matter of increasing the density of the communes, of circulation, and of solidarities, to the point that the territory becomes unreadable, opaque to all authority. We don't want to occupy the territory. We want to be the territory. End quote. The question here is very clearly not one of territorial autonomy, like Hawking Bay, or a reimagining of space, like the Situationists, but rather a question of opacity and unreadability. As Ken Wark writes in his book, Hacker Manifesto, there is a politics of the unrepresentable, a politics of the presentation of the non-negotiable demand. Strictly speaking, then, and using the language of ontology, it is not simply that a new cultural logic has been secreted from the mode of production, kind of Jamesonian formulation. then it is a claim about logic itself. For logic is the science of appearing, just as ontology is the science of being. And of course, to be neat and tidy about things, we ought to remember that these new digital devices are all logic machines to begin with. Tracking this current from the higher attributes downward, which is to say from time to extension, space, to ontics, presence, existence, I will now indulge in that most dismal science of prediction, certainly at my own peril, I'm sure. Sequentially then, after ontics comes ontology. So in the future, near or far, one might expect to see a new politics of being. That is to say, not simply a politics of durational or historical authenticity, or territorial dominance, or even identification and appearance, which is kind of a vanguard now, but quite literally a newfound struggle over what is and what can be. So substitute prevention with preemption, which of course was a big deal under Bush 2. Substitute the claim no one is illegal with the claim no being is illegal. Not just skirmishes over the politics of the body, but struggles over the politics of being. This will not resemble the 20th century critiques around essentialism and anti-essentialism, because post-Fordism put an end to that discussion once and for all, leaving us maybe wondering whether we really want what we wished for. It will be a materialist politics, to be sure, but also at the same time an immaterial or idealist war in which the old specter of the thought crime will certainly rear its ugly head again. And people will be put in jail for ideas and forms and scripts and scriptures, which is already happening, of course, in and around the new regime of digital copyright and the aggressive policing of immaterial property rights. And perhaps the future is already here, as the so-called source fetishists are already running rampant, be they the champions of the open source movement or the bioprospecting for new genetic sources deep within the Amazon jungle, or the mining for consumer essences deep within the Amazon website. What this means for criticism is another question altogether. The determining aspect of the dialectic today is not so much contradiction as such, or synthesis, or negation, or even the group of terms related to becoming, process, or historicity, but rather that of the asymmetrical binary. A binary so lopsided that it turns into a kind of policed monism, because it's so lopsided. So lopsided that the subjugated term is practically non-existent. And that synthesis itself is a mirage, a mere pseudo-technique, floated with the understanding it will be recouped, like a day trader floating a short-term investment. As Godard famously said, this is not a just image. This is just an image. So, if anything can be learned from the present predicament, it might be that a practical non-existence can emerge from a being that is practically non-existent. That subtractive being, this kind of N-1 idea, that subtractive being might be the only thing today that capitalism cannot eventually co-opt. So, just to end, we shall not say that there is a new blackness. We shall not ratify the rise of the obscure and the fall of the transparent. But do not decry the reverse either. Simply withdraw from the decision to ask the question. Instead, ask, what is this eternity? What is this black box, this black block that fills the world with husks and hulls and camouflage and crime? Is it our enemy, or are we on the side of it? Is this just a new kind of nihilism, or is it the purest form of love? Thanks a lot.